Good evening, everybody. And welcome to lesson 4 of the world of Kabbalah, more specifically the world of chaos. So being that we are a gathering of Jews here, we have the power of the community here, so we'll recite a prayer. I'll recite Psalm 122. That too? That's easy, that power. The power of prayer is even stronger. Chaos is easier. It's easier to destroy than to build, right? I'm going to recite it in Hebrew, representing all of us, and we'll have in mind all the families of, well, the hostages themselves for their safety. I'm going to recite 122. They should all come back safe and sound, and return to their families, and the members of the IDF should be well and safe and successful, and peace should reign very soon in Israel. Shasham alu shvatim shivte ya edis yisrael lehoidis Hashem Adonai kishama yashvu kisleis lemishpat kis ois leveiz David shalu shleim yirushalayim mishloi oyavoich shalom achilis avar mnetoich leman achai verei adabra nashalim bach lan beisat neileheinu avaksha toiv lach. So, once again, welcome back. I say this before many of the classes, But are we in for a class tonight? Sometimes when someone signs up for a Kabbalah course, or maybe before they sign up for a Kabbalah course, just by their little bit of interest in Kabbalah, they may have an idea of it, which makes it a little bit more, a little bit more eerie, a little bit more fluffy than what they would actually anticipate. Now, from lesson 1 to 3, you've already learned that that's not the case. And these ideas are big ideas, and serious ideas, and potentially life-changing ideas.
Are we going to learn how to make a golem or not?
But tonight, we're going to learn something totally different.
Is that lesson 7?
Tonight we're going to be learning a big, big Kabbalistic idea. And I'm letting you know in advance that if in every one of these classes we needed to put our thinking caps on, as they say in yeshiva, there's a saying in Yiddish that you have to halt kop. It means you have to stay focused and follow the. I'll do my best to make sure everything is presented in the most user friendly way, and that we kind of develop a thread and appreciate the flow of the ideas that we're going to learn tonight as well. So, just to sum up very briefly what we dealt with in the previous classes, we already had 3, which means that in the first class, we discussed the 3 worlds of Biyah, if you recall. On our map, it's right over here. The left side is the order of devolution, if you see. And on the bottom, remember we started from the bottom. We started with these 3 worlds, Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. I keep repeating these things every time we start, very briefly, just so that we kind of maintain an understanding of the flow. And to be honest, I study these ideas since I'm 15 years old, and it's the consistency of constantly revisiting it which helps that we eventually begin to absorb them. That's why instead of it just being something we learned in one class and moving on, we're kind of quickly refreshing so we know what we're building upon. So the 3 worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya, that's where God created otherness. If you recall, we said God wanted to be in a relationship and he needed another. He needed a separate, independent entity to the extent that is possible when it comes to God, because God is creating it. So ultimately, we're all part of God, but that's a separate point. For right now, what's relevant is that he created those 3 worlds, and that's where independence begins. Now that there's an other, he can enter a relationship. In the second class, we moved up a notch. We went to the world of Atzilut, which basically covers these 10 sefirot, these 10 energies. And we said that 3 of them are intellectual, then 7 are emotional. We talked about chesed and gvura, kindness versus discipline, how each one is has a strong personality of its own, and they don't fuse together with the other, and only with the power of the one above do they come together. And then last week, in lesson 3, we moved up to that yellow dot there, and that's called Keter, which literally means crown, but that we discussed in the context of our power of will, our willpower. That was last week's discussion that was related to the infinite light. Okay, these 10 faculties, we would not call them the infinite light because they are the way God emanates from himself into specific energies. So that is, once the infinite light takes on a certain identity, if you will. That was in lesson 2 where we discussed these 10 powers. But when you move up to Keter in lesson 3, we spoke about the willpower that represents the infinite light, and we talked about how the willpower has the ability to move a person to accomplish things, even if they may not be the most skilled in the world. But when we have the will to accomplish, then that is good enough to drive us until our goal. And then, now we're going to come to lesson 4 tonight. And we're not going to continue moving up on that map. We're actually going to discuss another dimension to something that we already talked about. But before we actually do that, so we talked about the fact how our our own souls, the design of our own souls, reflect that of God Almighty. Just like God has those 10 powers, we also do. We're created in the image of God. And actually, on the map, on the right side, we have like this parallel figure here, which is in the divine image, how we have all these powers. We started with thought, speech, action on the bottom. Then we moved up to these 3 intellectual, 7 emotional. Then we moved up to desire. So we basically reflect God himself and God's character, if you will. And that's how we are designed. So here's the issue. If we are actually created in God's image, why, when we want to do something good, when we want to do a mitzvah, when something positive maybe comes to your attention or comes knocking at your door, why do we have a hard time responding to it? Very often there are voices in our head that are telling us, maybe not, maybe it's not for me, I don't have time for this one, I can't afford that one, I don't have energy to attend that one, or for this prayer, or study, or volunteerism, or whatever. Now, of course, we all do some to an extent, but sometimes we find ourselves struggling to be able to do what's right. But if we are created in God's image, why do we have that struggle?
Because God also created the Eitz Hara.
Thank you, Jacob, because God gave us an additional gift. It's true that we are created in God's image, but in addition to that, we got something else. And we're going to learn about that something else tonight, and we're going to learn, most importantly, we're going to learn about its origin, which may surprise you. But first, let's talk about it itself. What is that evil inclination? What does it look like exactly within us? So in order to do that, I'm going to ask you to open to page 111. And I heard some of you already starting to work through this exercise. But we're actually going to do it together. And remember, you're with family here in the room. We're among our own, so we're going to make ourselves a little vulnerable. But the truth is, I'm overstating it. It won't be necessary. But here's what we're going to do in exercise 4.1. We have to figure out. We are going to figure out. I'm actually going to read these loud, and I'm going to ask all of you, and like I said, just feel comfortable to do so. Just call out yes or no after I read each one. And I'll tell you in advance what I'm anticipating, to make it a little easier for you. I'm anticipating that we all should answer yes to basically almost all of them. And we're all in the same boat. So, okay, just say yes or no after I read them. I am a selfish person.
Yes. Yes.
I am not a selfish person.
No.
I'm sure also yes, meaning I'm sure you can do things that are unselfish or selfless. Okay, I'm gonna keep moving. At times, now I'm talking about, I'm reading it as if all of you are reading it. So you respond as if you're reading it. At times, I really only care about myself and my well-being.
Yes.
Some things are more significant than my existence.
Yes.
Yes. I would never knowingly do something to hurt another person.
Yes.
Yes. I know that I've hurt others in pursuit of my goals.
Yes.
It hurts a little, but maybe a little bit of yes. I sometimes feel glad when someone else fails. That's a little troubling.
It depends.
Okay. Okay. I do not want to rejoice over someone else's troubles.
Yes.
When I want something, I find it very difficult to resist it, even when I recognize that it is harmful to my moral and spiritual well-being.
Yes.
I weigh short-term gains against the long-term harm they may invite.
Yes.
Okay. So what's the point here? What are we trying to accomplish? Human beings are complicated. That's pretty clear from what we just did, right? We identified with two statements. One, that we can be selfish, and we also identified with that we can be selfless. The same person answered yes to both, and that's probably for most of us, if not all of us. So on the one hand, we are able to do things that are altruistic, and we can all identify certain times in our life when we did something that was really altruistic. Altruistic, by the way, means 100% no agenda, no personal gain whatsoever. Because very often we do things which are good, and they're a favor to someone else, and they're a total good deed. But in the back of our mind, we may be thinking, well, I may get a favor back from that fellow one day. Or the fact that I'm doing it, you know, he'll probably tell that friend that I did it for him, it may benefit me. And there's nothing terrible with those thoughts, but we have those thoughts very often. But it makes it not 100% altruistic. But we are even able to do things that are 100% altruistic. Well, I mean, the easy one is that when, you know, mitzvahs that are related to people at the end of life where they can't repay you, do we do it anyway? Attending a funeral, etc.
You're doing the mitzvahs that reward up in heaven, right?
Yeah, but that's heavenly. That's we can't perceive that with our own eyes, with flesh and blood.
Did you anticipate it?
We do anticipate it. I'm not certain. Well, we know we have a promise from God that if we do the right thing, we will be rewarded for it. Yes. And by the way, this is why the Mishnah does teach that we shouldn't be driven by reward when it comes to do mitzvahs. We should do it because it's the right thing to do. And this is why, even within, I'm going off on a tangent a little bit, but even within, like, observant Jews, there's certain segments of Orthodox Jews that if you ask them what drives you to do a certain thing, they'll say that they're securing their seat in heaven, in the next world. And that's a little bit elementary. It's a little un-Hasidic, if you will. A Hasidic Jew will have a harder time telling you that they're doing it because they're trying to secure a front row seat in heaven. Because ultimately, that's selfish. You're doing it for yourself. If you're doing it for your own benefit, from my reward, okay, maybe you have a little bit more of a refined sense of reward. You're not looking for reward in this world, you're looking for reward in the next world. But that's still a little elementary to a degree. The real motivation to do a mitzvah should be because it's the right thing to do, and that's what God told us to do, period. Nothing else matters. But, like I said, it's a tall order. We're capable of doing that, but not necessarily every mitzvah that we do is so 100% altruistic, and that's fine. The point we want to make right now is that we sometimes find ourselves doing things that are selfish. The same person could also find themselves doing things that are selfless. And that's because we are driven by, did Do you ever hear of the Kabbalistic idea called the two-soul doctrine? Raise your hand if you did. Okay. That means you may have attended a JLI before.
Many.
Okay. Or you've studied some other Torah ideas. What does that mean? What that means is, and maybe let's read text number one. Linda, I think I'm going to ask you to do it. You look like you're up to a reading. On page 112, this is straight out of the Tanya.
The first of our souls originates in non-holiness. This soul resides in our bloodstream to vitalize our body. It is the source of all our negative character traits, as well as those positive traits that come naturally to us, such as compassion and kindness. A Jew's second soul is an actual part of the transcendent God.
Thank you, thank you. So sometimes in certain, I don't know, other schools of thought, whether other religions or whatever, sometimes people are viewed as if they have like these two, they have these two different, they have like the voice of the devil and the voice of whatever, the side of good, and that's kind of what pulls them in different directions. What Kabbalah teaches is that every single one of us are endowed with two souls. We have first and foremost, we have what we're going to call an animal soul. When we say animal soul, doesn't mean that it's an animal. It means that its primary objective is self-preservation. Just like an animal looks out for itself, and it's not, it's just an animal doing what it's supposed to do. And it kind of has its survival instinct is first and foremost and highest priority. That's what this animal soul is driven by, just looking out for its own needs. And that's one side of ourselves, is the animal soul. It's just that it concerns itself with things like an animal, pursuing what it needs, pursuing what it wants. Now, in addition to that, we also have what we're going to call the godly soul. And that is a totally different drive. Drives us to do things that are godly. And it's because of our godly soul that we're capable of doing things that are totally altruistic. When we do something, even something good, but we kind of think in the back of our mind that we may benefit from doing that favor for somebody, that good deed is driven by the animal soul, because the animal soul also looks out for itself. So if I'm going to help somebody because it will benefit me, That is not being motivated by my godly soul. That's being motivated by my animal soul. When I do something totally not for myself, like literally there's nothing in it for me at all, and somebody needs me when nobody else is watching, nobody's going to know ever that I ever did this favor for the other person. No rewards, no accolades, I'm not going to be honored at any gala event because of this mitzvah. When I do that one, that is driven by the godly soul. Because we have that godly soul, we're capable of doing something which has nothing to do with the self. It is totally selfless. Yes?
Are they really two souls or two aspects of the same soul?
Two souls. Two souls. That's the two-soul doctrine. Two different souls that we are endowed with. Two different nefashot, as they're called here. Generally, yes. Although, to be more precise, one is called the godly soul, the other is called the animal soul in Kabbalistic terms. Now, the Yetzer Tov means that you have a good inclination within the godly soul. It's an okay term. It's just that it doesn't really identify the soul in its entirety. But yes, those are kind of results of those souls.
Phyllis. Something that just makes you feel good for having done it.
It's still the animal soul.
Okay, even though nobody else knows about it or anything.
Well, it depends. It depends. If somebody does something totally selfless, now it's possible that when I do something, it really, you know, it's. Sometimes it can get a little bit, there's some gray area. I mean, what you're describing may be an opportunity to do something which There's no reward for you at all, but you do feel good by doing it. Now, it depends if that was driving you, was the motivation that I will feel good when I do it, or did you do it because it was the right thing to do? And it happens to be, when you do something right, it also feels right. So maybe that's the difference. But there's nothing wrong with it feeling right after you do something right. It's actually the correct feeling to have. But if that's the only thing that's motivating us, then maybe it's still driven by the animal soul, because it's ultimately, I want to feel good. If I want to feel good, then that's, it's just, luckily, that individual feels good when someone else feels good. So he's certainly better off than many others. So, we've been saying that we are complex creatures, altruistic, spiritual, connected to God on one hand, selfish drives and hedonistic instincts on the other. And the animal soul is, in Hebrew, it's called nefesh habahamit. It's one of our terms that we have here on page 112. It means animal soul. It's uniquely human, meaning it's not the same soul as an animal has. It just like the animal, it is self-driven or self-centered. But it's a uniquely human soul. It's survival, physical needs. That's the number one priority that it looks out for, gratification, and even positive traits, but those that are self-oriented. And it could even drive a person to immoral behavior. When I'm looking out for myself and self-gratification, sometimes it could even take us to a place that is immoral, but we justify it along the way, and that's why we could possibly end up there. And then we have the nefesh habahamit, which is the animal soul, also a key term, the human soul that is self-oriented and can trigger immoral behavior. So that's what sums up the animal soul. Then we have the godly soul, and that is a relationship with God. That's what it brings us to, and a relationship with other souls. Basically, anything outside of the self, whether it's toward God or toward other people, is all going to be coming from the godly soul, and it's what drives us to fulfill its God-given mission and to focus on what it's needed for. You ever heard that line? Ask not what the country could do for you. Ask what you could do for the country, which was actually stated by Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the author of the Tanya, 150 years before John F. Kennedy. He once said to someone in who came to meet him, similar line. He said he came to the Rebbe with a whole shopping list of needs, and he said, "I only heard from you what your needs are, but what you are needed for, that you didn't mention anything." So each soul drives another one of those things. The animal soul is what our needs are. The godly soul is what we are needed for. Why am I here? What am I needed for? Just a little bit of an illustration. This one rabbi came into the lunchroom once at the yeshiva, and he sees one of his students was enjoying lunch. He said, "Are you enjoying your are you?" He noticed he was eating. He had fish for lunch. He said, "Are you liking the fish?" He said, "I'm loving the fish." He said, "Really? You love the fish?" He said, "If you were loving the fish, you would be treating it very differently. You would be feeding it. You would be taking care of it. You wouldn't be killing the fish and chopping it up and eating it. You're doing so not because you love the fish, but because you love yourself. You love yourself. That's why you're doing that to the fish. That's why you're eating it." So it really depends on what is driving us. We have to always think about what we are loving when we're doing it. Are we doing something for someone because we love them, or are we doing something for them because we love ourselves? So in text number 2, we have this very important component about the animal soul. And that is, Mark, would you like to read it? Please.
"The ox's strength produces abundant crops. That is to say, the animal soul's drive is more potent than the godly soul's drive."
Thank you. So here's the thing when it comes to these two souls. Here's the thing. Which soul do you think comes to the person first, the godly soul or the animal soul?
Animal.
Why do you say that? Okay, it is correct. We actually receive our animal soul sooner than we get our godly soul. In fact, when we're born, we already get our animal soul. Our godly soul begins to enter us when we're born, but it's a long process. We actually don't have it fully and 100% until our bar or bat mitzvah, which is why at that age we become responsible to fulfill all the commandments of the Torah. Why are we suddenly responsible? Because now we have the full capacity and full intensity of our godly soul. So we have what it takes to be able to do what we need to do. That's why that's when we're obligated. We can't start the obligation earlier because we don't have the tools, so to speak. We don't have our godly soul fully. So the animal soul comes in first, immediately. And it's also more powerful, as we just said. Right?
So why do females get it at 12 and males at 13?
Because females are more innately bound up with God and more spiritual. So they, a year earlier than boys, they resonate easier with spirituality. So they mature spiritually sooner, and that's why they have the bat mitzvah at 12. So actually delaying it to mimic the boys is actually doing a disservice to the girl. It's not a compliment. So
can you back that up, Rabbi?
What's that? Because they're more connected to God. They have they resonate with spirituality naturally. They mature spiritually sooner.
Okay, okay.
I mean, I see this firsthand in my work. The women are always first to connect spiritually.
Empirical observations. You're saying you see it yourself.
I do see it myself, but I didn't make it up. All I'm saying is that in my experience, I also notice that truth. Again, it's a tangent, but it's for the same reason why in Judaism, men have more obligations than women. Because women don't need the obligations to stay connected to God. They're connected naturally, and they resonate naturally, and more essentially. Men, on the other hand, if they don't have specific rituals in certain times and in certain places, they're gonna end up deviating much easier and much quicker. They need a specific program to keep them grounded, and that too I see very very clearly. Okay, so let's see what's going on here. Let's try to bring this together. What we said so far, and that is. So we spoke about the fact that the animal soul is stronger, right? You heard of a term horsepower before, right? You never heard of human power. That's because animals are stronger than humans. So the animal soul is stronger and more intense. It's more of a powerful force in the person. Say, for example, when the weather is bad one evening, or it's snowing outside, let's say not in Houston, and it may be a little difficult to come out to a Talmud class that evening. There may be a smaller crowd, but it's still going to be possible that same evening to have 30,000 people cheering at a sports game, same under the same weather. Why is that the case? Because what draws us to a game is the animal soul. Not that there's, again, I want to emphasize, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's not necessarily godly. It's just mundane. But that, people won't have a problem mustering up the energy to get themselves there. But to a class in the same weather, it may be more difficult for the same reason, because the animal soul is stronger and it has a greater intensity, and it gets its way. easier than the godly soul, than what it takes for the godly soul to achieve that. I just want to say one other thing. You asked before if these are two aspects to the same soul. The answer is, as I said, that these are two different souls. The problem is this. We have two souls, but we have one heart and one set of legs. So we can't go to two places in one time. Meaning, if one soul wants to go to the game and the other wants to go to the shul, okay, if we had two different hearts and two sets of legs, okay, maybe that would work. The problem is that we have two souls, but there's only one body. So we can only do one or the other. And that's where the struggle comes in. Which one of the souls is going to gain control over the me, over my heart, my emotions, and therefore my behavior and my action? What am I actually going to do? It's all going to be driven by either one or the other souls. And that's where the daily struggle kicks in. All right. So, with this, we kind of presented the idea of the two souls. Now, what we're coming to here, is like this. If you remember, we've been studying, and I also noted it in the beginning of tonight's class, that we are in a mirror image of God, of God's powers, faculties, and we have the same in our own soul. We have those 10 faculties, those 10 energies. But here's the thing, and this is, we're kind of coming to the big idea number one that we're going to be discovering tonight. And that is, so you see these 10 powers right here? We've been talking about them since lesson 2.
I couldn't find Orange in your Apple Music
I'm
library.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. So this represents the 10 powers of Atzilut, which are reflected in our own soul. Here's the question now. You see how there's kind of two colors in each one?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a reason for that.
Oh, really? I thought it was just
but before we actually say that, I want to bring to your attention that when we say that we have those 10 powers, we actually have each one of these two souls that we have their own set of 10 powers. Okay? So we have our godly soul, which has all those 10 powers, image of God, just like they exist within within God's character, that they exist within us. But we don't only have one set of those 10 powers. We actually have another set. Each one of our souls has their own set of these powers. So, for example, let's say we talk about kindness. So I can do kindness that's driven by my godly soul, or I can do kindness that's driven totally by my animal soul. And this is not the same power, so to speak, expressing itself in one way or a different way. There's two totally different sets within our own character of each one of these 10. So we have two souls. Each soul has its own set of powers.
Doesn't matter.
Very good question. Doesn't matter. But we have a divine soul. We have an animal soul. What we're saying is that the animal soul also has its own powers. The question is, what's the objective or what's the purpose, right? So the question is, a few questions that we, just to sum up whatever we said till now, which is going to bring us into the next part of our discussion. The question is, number one, we said it's very nice that we have these two souls. The question is, why do we have the two souls? Not only why do we have it, but how is it possible that one of them is incompatible with God? It seems weird. If we said that we're in the image of God, how do we suddenly have another soul and another set of faculties that are not aligned with God? Where does it come from? If we're in a mirror image of God, then how can we have a side to ourself that suddenly is animalistic? Am I making sense? That's going to be the driving question here. we described at length that this is a truth. This is a this is a reality within us. However, if we've been building up for the last three sessions already that we reflect God, then where does the animal soul come from, and where do the 10 faculties within it come from? What are they mirroring? If we are a mirror image of God, are we saying that within God there is such a thing? There's an animal soul? Of course not. So what is the origin of this animal soul? Where does it come from? Why do we have it? And how does it contain and kind of possess within itself these 10 faculties of its own? And of course, we're also going to discover, why is it stronger? Why is it more powerful than the godly soul? Okay, so this will lead us to where we need to go next. Is everything clear so far? Thank you. And thank you, Lou. Okay, so it's going to get even funner.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
So we have a godly soul, we have an animal soul, we also have a soulmate, right? So what if you're having your soulmates, is the godly soul that hooks up, or is it both souls that have to hook up with her both souls? And what if only the godly souls hook up, but the animal souls are incompatible?
So you're saying which soul are we, when we say soulmate, what does that mean? So what soulmate means, by the way, according to Kabbalah, that a male and female originated as one soul. So when you marry your soulmate, before you were born and before your soulmate was born, your soul, let's just say half male and half female, was really two halves of the same soul. And then they were separated. The male, every soul has both components, male and female. It's not for tonight's topic, but within God there's male and female. And every soul has that. Now, once it comes into this world, it's either a male or a female. So the soul is split. The male side goes into a male. The female side of the same soul, okay? Another side of the same coin. The female side of the soul goes into a female. And then these two people who are two halves of the same soul need to find each other. And they roam around the world until they eventually do find each other. And that's why a marriage is a reunion. It's not just a union, it's a reunion, because the two halves of the same soul are coming back together. That's why they're called soulmates. So you're asking, which soul is that? Well, in all likelihoods, we're talking about the godly soul. Although not necessarily, and I'm not sure if
it matters.
Well, if it gets us a godly soul, then they don't end up in divorce. But if it's the animal soul, chances are you get divorced.
Well, it doesn't matter which soul we have. The key is of what we do with that soul. So it's really about the choices that we make every day, as we discussed last week, and we'll discuss a little bit still today, that when you have two opposing entities, which in no way would be naturally compatible with each other, but it's only when they both submit to something higher than each other, then they're able to kind of, as we said, the osa shalom bimromav, right? We talked about a chuppah. What's the pot? Why do we get married under a chuppah? Because that cover from above represents the infinite light of God, and only the infinite light could bring together the finite energies that are beneath it. So yes, when we do it right, and we're willing to curb our own ego, that's the best ingredient for a successful marriage. And like we noted last week, that before we say Osa Shalom, we take three steps back. So when we're willing to give up a little bit, then things work out well. All right, let's advance here, because we have big ideas today. And I'm going to do my best, like I said before. and we're gonna move forward like this. In order to appreciate all this, we're gonna kind of get into a whole. We're gonna take a serious detour, and we're going to explore a super Kabbalistic idea tonight. And if you look at your map, and I think we also looked over here before, that we saw how each one of the Sfirot, are actually have two colors here. So what's going on? I'm just going to catch up here on the slides. What is going on here? Why do we have two colors on each one? So the reason for that is because every single sphera consists of two things. Okay, you're going to hear a lot about these two things tonight. And the two things are, the first one is light, the second one is vessel. Okay, just like we had water in my cup before, the water is the light, the cup is the vessel. That's what each one of these sphirot consist of. When we say a spiritual energy, faculty, power, whatever name we were using, and they're all correct, each one of these 10, remember the 3 intellectual, the 7 emotional, kindness, severity, whatever, whichever one, every single one of them is not just an energy. It consists of a light and a vessel. Everything is light and vessel. And this is what text number 3 tells us, straight from the Zohar. Colin, want to read text number 3, please, on page 114. It's a short one.
The king is present within the 10 attributes of Azeroth. He and his vessels are one in that world. He and his light are one in that world.
Thank you. We have light and we have vessels. Okay? So in Kabbalistic language, light represents the abstract energy that's behind a given reality. So let's just say, choose any one of these 10 powers, okay? Let's just say chesed, because we spoke a lot about it, which means kindness. So this chesed consists of two things. First and foremost, it consists of a light. When we say light, light means like an abstract energy that's undefined, that doesn't have any specific structure or character. That's the light. But then you also have the vessel. The vessel is what brings structure and that shapes this energy and kind of executes it. So let's just say if chesed was only a light without a vessel, it actually wouldn't even be chesed. It would just be a raw, undefined energy. It only gets its definition when there is a vessel and the light and the vessel unite with each other. The vessel gives the energy, its identity of chesed. Without the vessel, it doesn't have any identity. In fact, I remember learning that you can actually switch out energies from one to another, and it will still work, because the energy that is in one vessel, on its own, it's undefined. So two energies could play musical chairs and take on the identity of the vessel that it goes into. I'm going to use we'll still explain it really well. But before I even go further, if this cup, so this is a clear plastic cup. Okay, what if I also had a cup that was blue, red, and green, and I poured water into each one of them? And you're just looking at the water through the side of the cup. What color would the water be? So in this cup, the water was colorless, just whatever, we'll just say clear. If the cup was blue and you were looking at it, what color would the water look like? Blue. What if I then take the blue glass and I pour that water into the red glass? What's it going to look like now? Clear. Into the red glass from the blue. It was blue when it was in the blue glass. If I pour it into a red one and you look at the side, it's not going to look like red. My point is that the water doesn't have an identity or a color. It's the same water. But when you put it into a blue cup, it's going to look like blue water. If I take that same water and pour it into a yellow one, it's not going to look like it's yellow. Is the water really taking on this definition? No, only as long as it's in that vessel. it takes on that identity. But if I take it out of that glass and I pour it into a different one, it will take on the identity of the other glass. What we're saying here is that each one of these sefirot consists of a light and a vessel, but the definition and the structure comes from the vessel, not the light. But when we talk about this, let's look at page 115. This will help us appreciate it. Okay, think of a book. A book has ideas and it has words. Which one of these two is the light? Which one's the vessel? Okay, a book has ideas. Someone has an idea. That's the light. But then they take a pen and a paper or a computer and they start typing and they put their idea into words. Words is the vessel for the idea. The idea is the light. The words are the vessel. Next one, a melody. You have emotions, which is like the light. And then you have the musical notes, which capture those emotions. Again, you have light and vessel. Think about a business. Somebody wants to open a business. And they have a vision of what they want to accomplish or what their business is going to be like. So the vision is the light. But then you need a strategy. And the strategy is the vessel of how you're going to take that vision, give it identity, and give it specifics, and allow it to become, take on a specific definition. A relationship. A relationship has, you could be in love, but if you're only in love, and that love doesn't express itself in any specific actions, then it's light without a vessel. Specific actions, expressions of love, that's like the vessel to the love, which is the light. And finally, in the context of religion, you have beliefs, but then you also have rituals which allow those beliefs to kind of be expressed or manifest. Are we making sense so far?
Yep.
Okay. So, now, if you only have one without the other, if you have light without the vessel, then it will never be captured. You won't be able to do anything with it. The other way around, you may have a vessel, you may have words, right? I can actually take a pen, I could write out, let's say I take a pen and a paper and I write out D-O-G on the paper. What does it say? Why does it say dog? There's no dog on this paper. It only says it because I spelled out those three specific letters. What if I rearrange the letters? So it happens to be, it will say God, but let's say I rearrange it again. Let's say I rearrange it again. Then it's not going to say anything. I still have the vessels. They're still the same three letters are there, but they're not in the right order, so they don't capture any light. The light is not there. The light vanished once you rearrange the letters. You still have the letters, you still have the vessels, but they're not capturing anything within them because they're not organized in the right way. Okay? Making sense, right? All right, so now let's come back to the divine sefirot, where each sefira is made up of a light and a vessel. So the light, we already know by now. All of you could already be teaching this part. The light is God emanating from himself, from his infinite light. He emanated from himself these 10 powers. But when he did that, he also emanated 10 vessels, a vessel for each one of these 10 lights, so that it can capture it and give it the definition that it needs. Now, why does the light need a vessel? Well, just like in all those examples that we just gave, in order to capture that love, that emotion, that idea, or that vision, you need a vessel. Otherwise, it's just an abstract light and nothing, it's not going to manifest in any specific way. Here too, if God wants that those energies should take on a certain identity and they should have a certain function, they need a vessel which is going to give them that identity. Why do they really need that? Because the light itself, as we also discussed in the previous class, I believe last week, when you say light, that is an indication that we're talking about something that's deeply connected to its source. I think we said last week that if you turn off the switch, the light is gone. Why? Because the illuminator is gone. The source of the light is removed. The light vanishes with the source immediately. Unlike certain other things, which you could remove the source, but the flow could still stick around. Like the AC, for example. It's not going to get hot immediately. The air will still stick around. Light, uniquely, when you remove the source, it totally vanishes. So these 10 powers, each one is a divine light, an infinite light. So what is their nature? If it was up to the light itself is very much, has a very deep desire to be subsumed by its source and to, so to speak, return to God. That's what the light wants. If it was up to the light itself, it's not interested in going on missions or taking on definitions or structure. The light is deeply connected to God. It just wants to be one with God. So, because of that nature that light has, if there wouldn't be a vessel that would be capturing it and giving it identity and structure, the light would just get lost. It would vanish and return to its source within God. It would become subsumed within God without the vessel doing its part.
Is this applicable to the animal soul too? Is God's light in the animal soul?
We'll come back to the animal soul. Hold the thought. At the end. But we have to first develop this idea. Yes.
So the light that is emanated from God ends up in a different sphere, Kavura and Hesed. It's the same light. It doesn't have a characteristic of its own until it is in the vessel.
Correct. Right? Correct. One more idea on this. Okay, say for example, you're a father and your child is playing in the playground with kids, and you learn that your young boy just got hurt. So any normal father is going to be like really angry at what just happened. So that anger is like undefined energy right now. The question is now, what am I going to do with this pent-up energy? There's various different ways that I can channel it. I can go scream at the school principal of how such a thing was allowed to happen. I can go embrace my child and make sure he's okay. I can go check out to see what's happening with the child who hurt him, to see what his issue is. Maybe he needs compassion too. So the point is that there's various different ways where this anger could be channeled. So as long as it's within me immediately, I have that energy, it's still undefined. But then I can take it and channel it in one of a variety of different options, or maybe even more than one. But that's becoming the vessel to that energy within me. And as we read in Lou, you'll help me with some readings here. The good news is they're all short, but I'm going to ask you to stick around. All the fours are going to be Lou's, okay? We're going to read 4A on page 116, please.
The light itself is in a state of simple abstractness. The vessel imposes a definition on the light in the form of particular attributes of wisdom, kindness, and so forth.
Okay, so that already makes sense to us, this text, because we already discussed it. The light itself is abstract. It doesn't have a specific identity. The identity comes from the vessel. In other words, they have to work together. You have to have both of them. When both are doing their thing, when the energy is emanating, the vessel is like integrating this energy and giving that energy a certain character and definition and identity, then it's wonderful. They're both doing their job. Okay? Everyone good? Okay. So I'm just going to very quickly go through these slides. There are two parts of each sphera. There is what we call Orot. Orot means the lights, abstract divine energies that are closely tied to their source, but are primed to produce divine attributes. Okay, makes sense? Next. Kalim, that's plural for Kali, vessels. Divine entities of definition and structure that define the lights and channel their energy to the lower worlds. Okay, so remember this, very important. The lights are infinite, and the light itself would stay in heaven if it was up to it. The vessel's job is to take that light, give it definition, and allow it to execute and to function. So the Orot are abstract rather than defined, and then desire to be with their source and not channeled elsewhere. So I think this is where we have to hone in for a minute. So the first thing, here we are. So the first thing that we said about what the vessel does, the vessel gives the structure, but then there's another thing, very important. The second important feature that the vessel introduce are as follows. You ever looked at a candle, a flame? I'm sure. What do you see when you look at the flame? You actually see something in this physical world, and I'm not sure there's a parallel to anything else within this physical realm, where you see something that actually doesn't want to be here. The flame, just naturally, is constantly being drawn upward. It doesn't want to be here, and if not for the wick holding it down, it actually wouldn't be here. It wouldn't stay here. The only reason why it's here is because it's being forced to be here, because there's a wick and there's oil, so it's being held down. Now, what the fire does is it consumes whatever's in its way, and not because it's trying to destroy what's in its way. It wants to consume whatever's around it so that it itself can just leave this earthly reality and return and be subsumed back into its source. Its heavenly source of fire, wherever that is. So it physically is something that is only here because it's being captured and forced to be here. This can kind of help us understand what we're describing here when we talk about a light and vessel. So the second function of the vessel is like the wick to the fire. The second function is that the infinite light of those sephirot, of all 10 of them, the light itself, like the fire, doesn't want to be bothered with like taking on definitions and needing to be lowered and executed into a lowly world. It wants to stay in its source. It's very happy there. The keli, the vessel, has the job of making sure that it kind of captures it so that it should do what its job is. So think of like, I'm just trying to illustrate this a little bit more. Think of like a couple who are in a all-consuming love. And they want to be with each other, okay? So even when they're separate, they're constantly thinking about each other and they want to reunite. And when they are experiencing these feelings, very hard to be productive and do something else. So if the light is constantly being consumed by its desire to return to God, it can't really start getting busy with a vessel and taking on identity and being captured into like a specific function, etc. Because it's totally all consumed by wanting to connect with its source. Okay? So the second function of the vessel is to channel that energy and to channel it outward. The first thing we said is it gives it character and it gives it definition and structure. The second thing the vessel needs to do for the light is to make sure and kind of get it to integrate it to the extent that it should do what it needs to do and kind of emanate and be channeled outward, because naturally it has no interest in it and doesn't do it. The vessel is what makes that possible. Let's read 4b, Lou, when you can, please. Continuing from 4a.
Lights of Atzilut, by their very nature, are abstract. They also aspire to return to their source and to become wholly subsumed within their sublime origin. Accordingly, they are far removed from creating the worlds of Berea, Yetzirah, and Asiya. Rather, the lights must first install themselves into the vessels of Atzilut in order to energize the creation of the worlds.
Thank you. So what's happening here? So it's becoming clear that in order for this combination of light and vessel to work out, they both need to do opposite of what their nature is. They're each naturally inclined to something, and they both need to do the opposite of it. We already established that the light naturally wants to become subsumed back to heaven. It doesn't want to detach from its source. It doesn't want to go away from its love, so to speak, the infinite light from God. It wants to stay close to God. Taking on the identity of one of the Sephirot is not in its interest. It needs to go against its natural inclination to do that. So that's A. Second thing is that the vessel also needs to do something different than its nature. Its nature is to kind of stick around and connect with what's lower than it. It doesn't want to get busy with capturing light and needing to kind of connect with what's higher than it. Each one wants to go the other direction. The light wants to go higher. The vessel wants to go lower. They both need to deviate from their natural inclination, and only then are they able to integrate with each other. Am I making sense? They both have a specific nature. They both need to go against their nature. The light naturally wants to go up and needs to come down and take on a character, a specific one. The vessel is the opposite. The vessel doesn't want to be dealing with these lights and needing to capture infinite light. It's not where its natural place is. But in order for this objective to unfold successfully and to be executed, they both need to go against their natural order. In other words, on paper, the light and vessel are like a terrible match. It's the worst shidduch in the world. They have nothing in common. Each one wants to go the other direction. And the question is, how is this match going to happen? And the only way it could happen is, as we will see, let's see 4C and D, please.
Lights and vessels are inherently opposites. The lights, by their very nature, are abstract. They also aspire to return to their source, to become wholly subsumed within their sublime origin. By contrast, vessels have a defined nature. They desire to retain their configuration and are naturally inclined to descend to lower realms.
So that is their nature. The question is, how do they come together then? How do we make a match here? Go on to 4D, please.
They are entirely submitted to God's intent for creation, namely, that the universe should become an orderly habitat and not be left in chaos.
Okay, so here's the key. They are entirely submitted to God's intent for creation. The only way that the light and vessel could come together to integrate with each other and carry out what they need to is if they both realize that there's something greater than them, and if they're committed to a certain goal and objective that God gives them. If they're able to internalize that it's worthwhile to function opposite of what they're naturally drawn to, okay, what would get them to do something different than their nature? Only if they would realize that God has a certain objective here and they both need to submit to that. That is how the two can come together, even though they naturally are of two very different kinds. Just to give you a little illustration, but first, Michael.
I'm having a little trouble. Can you rephrase this business about the vessels being inclined to descend to lower realms?
So the light is more abstract, right? So it's like the soul. The vessel is like the body. So they're very different. They're made of very different stuff. The soul is super spiritual, and it wants to be even more spiritual than it is. It wants to connect with all the more spirituality that it can. It has no interest in being sent on missions to go into vessels and take on identities of specific functions. It's not where it's at. It wants to just stay close to God. The vessel has an opposite interest. The vessel is of a more coarse nature. We're still talking within the spiritual realm. I'm just saying that again. Let's not look at it as something physical. But within spirituality, it's of a lower status. Let's just say it has definition. Not only it has definition itself, it would be giving definition to the light. In other words, the body here, or namely the vessel, has an opposite nature, and it doesn't want to be carrying out its duty, so to speak, of capturing infinite light. It's not what it has an interest in. The light has an interest of going higher, the vessel of going lower. But nonetheless, because they realize that there's something beyond them at stake, so they need to come together and integrate with each other to carry out a certain purpose and mission. By the way, at the end, this is all going to make sense, even if it doesn't yet. I mean, it could make sense, but we're actually going to, it's going to make all the more sense when we get to the end. A little illustration here. Okay, let's just say it's Sunday morning, and the couple are, they're up Sunday morning, they're having coffee, reading the newspaper or whatever, and they're really enjoying each other's company, and the husband really wants to be around his wife. And then at one moment, she says, actually, could you go to the bagel shop and get me my favorite bagel? So what's he going to do? He really wants to be around his wife right now. And she's telling him, go get me a bagel. So it really depends. Kind of comes back to what we were saying earlier. It depends who he's in love with. If he's in love with himself, then he's going to have no interest in going to get the bagel because he wants to be around her. But if he's in love with her, and right now she wants him to go get the bagel, then he's going to go get the bagel. The point is that the light is madly in love with God. It doesn't want to detach. It doesn't want to be sent away and take on definitions and characters and etc. However, the only way it would do that is if it realizes that this God, that the light, the infinite light, wants to be connected to and doesn't want to detach from, that same God actually wants you to go on this mission, to go get me that bagel. In this case, this light needs to be united with that vessel and take on an identity of chesed, gevura, tiferet, etc. So even though naturally it just wants to be next to God, but if you're in love with God, then you really want to prove that by actually doing what God wants of you. Just like the spouse, you may be madly in love and want to be around her right now, but she wants you to go get the bagel. So if you're really in love, then you're going to step away from her to go carry out what that mission is. And that's really what this light needs to do. In order to establish that it really is deeply in love with God, then it needs to carry out its purpose and mission. Okay, so far so good. Yeah, everyone with me? Okay. It's still going to get better. I'm going to have to condense the next section to some degree. Let's just catch up here very quickly. So we have the light here, the orot, abstract rather than defined, desire to be with their source and not channeled elsewhere. The vessels, on the other hand, don't sense their source or desire to be connected, interested in what's happening below. So in order for it to do what God wants from it, they both need to go against their nature. Okay, for the next phase, this is going to get a little fun here, okay? This is the opening verses to the Torah, right? In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. What does it say next in the next verse? And the world or the earth was?
Tohu
vavohu. What does that mean? Tohu, anybody?
Void.
Chaotic.
Chaotic. Vavohu may be desolate.
Unformed.
Okay. And darkness on the face of the earth. And the Spirit of God was hovering above the water. And then verse 3 says, and God said, let there be light. And there was light. Okay. So, we're going to look at these verses, which is the opening of the Torah, from a Kabbalistic perspective. And of course, it has the literal meaning, which we all know, but now we're going to look at it from a Kabbalistic point of view. And by the way, you have it in text number 5. Let there be light, according to the Kabbalist, is referring to the light of Atzilut. Basically, those 10 Sefirot. That's the light that God said, let there be light. There was his infinite light, but then he said, let there be specific light. And that's the world of Atzilut. Let there be light refers to the emanation of Atzilut. And then, it was desolate, which means the prior emanation before Tzimtzum, which we're still going to learn about in one of the coming classes. So what happened here? The problem here was like this. The problem here was as follows. What we just described for the last half hour about lights and vessels and how they need to be integrated with each other, there's a name for that system or that world or that successful function. Okay, that name is one word. It's called tikkun. Anyone know what that means? To fix. Or basically, it could mean like functioning. A functioning system. When the system functions, then the lights and the vessels are integrated with each other, and they're doing their thing. However, the Torah tells us in these opening verses that what does it say? The earth was chaotic and desolate. And I'm looking at text 6, by the way. And this refers to the breaking of the vessels. And then the next line, God's Spirit hovered over the water. This refers to the lights that the vessels failed to absorb. So basically, the Kabbalists are introducing us to a fascinating concept here. That before the world was created the way we know it, and when we say world, we don't only mean this world, but also the spiritual realms that we've been talking about since our first session, and what we spoke about for the last half hour of all these lights and vessels and functioning in a healthy way, and they're integrated with each other. That's all called tikkun. That's the functioning system that we're all part of right now for the last 5,784 years. But we're getting insight about a reality that was created before this world of tikkun. And that's called the world of tohu. It was a chaotic world. What was chaotic about it?
God's light.
Basically, this system of lights and vessels needing to integrate with each other was not happening. It wasn't going right. In other words, the light was too busy with what it wanted. It had no interest in going into the vessels, in being absorbed in the vessels, and the vessels had no interest in capturing this light. Basically, they each were not interested in doing their thing, because that's what happened. So the whole system became chaotic. It was tohu vavohu. So
God had to pull back some of the light, right?
What happened was, he didn't have to pull back the light. The light itself returned, because the light was not being captured into the vessels, it itself returned to its source. When that happened, the vessels shattered. You may have heard this Kabbalistic idea of shattered vessels. And it pertains to a lot of different things. We're not going to cover everything tonight. Just a few things. So, the reason why this world was chaotic was because the match of the lights and vessels was not going successfully. And each one was not, so to speak, willing to carry out its purpose and mission successfully to integrate with the other. Because that wasn't happening, everything shattered. and there was what's known as broken vessels. Now, this is all purposeful. This is all purposeful because God is not a human who writes like one edition of a book and then says, you know what, I don't like the first edition, I'm going to go to the next one, I'm going to rewrite it. We can't suggest that about God. It's not like he first created the world, but it didn't really work out, so he started a different one. It was all intentional, and it was all purposeful. So the question is, what is the purpose of this world of Tohu, of this chaotic world? Why did God create it? So to speak, it failed. But nonetheless, these vessels shattered. And by the way, these shattered vessels were kind of like preserved. They weren't like just thrown out and like delete and start all over. That's not what happened. The light kind of vanished, but the vessels shattered. And those pieces, of course, we're talking everything here is spiritual, not physical. But they, so to speak, were preserved. But what role do they play? Why were they held onto? Why was it necessary? Because there's no mistakes in the system. Why was it necessary, and why are we still holding on to it? And the reason is because it actually still serves a purpose. And let's see what that purpose is. We are at 7a. Phyllis, could you please read that for us?
The lights of Tohu were intense and powerful. They intensely desired to be nullified and subsumed within their emanating source. They had no sense of what their source wanted of them. As a result, they failed to deviate from their default nature for the sake of submitting to their greater purpose.
Thank you. Because they failed, in this time around, they failed to realize what their purpose was, and they didn't carry it out, so everything went haywire, the lights vanished, the vessels shattered, and it didn't work out. So the question now is, because this commitment that these lights had to return to its source, because they were very set on that, that proved that they were out of sync with God's ultimate purpose. If they're not realizing that they were given a job, they were assigned a certain role, and they need to carry it out, they're basically not aligned. So they were, so to speak, they returned to their source because they failed to internalize what they were there for in the first place. So that led to this shattering. Let's go on to 7b, Phyllis, as well, please, on 122.
The vessels could not contain the light because they were not sufficiently submissive to share with the light's intense abstractness. They acted like a wick resistant to the flame, resulting in the flame slipping away.
Thank you. So just think of a fire that you're trying to light, and it's refusing to hold. You're not able to get it onto the wick. That's kind of basically what happened there. The lights vanished. It wasn't able to be captured, and it was gone. So basically, it resulted in this unhappy marriage between the lights and the vessels. Didn't really work out well, and the lights refused to become defined sephirot. The vessel didn't want to serve the lights. So we ended up with broken vessels. The lights slipped back to their source, and the vessels ceased being receptacles. That's what happened here. And so now, just to sum it up, and then we'll go to the last 10 minutes, which is very important to get to the culmination of this whole buildup. What we said in very short, we talked about the fact that we each have two souls. We have an animal soul, and we have a godly soul. Each one is responsible for driving us in different directions. The question is, if we are a mirror image of God, where does this animal soul even come from? What is it a mirror image of? If God doesn't have this soul, where do we get it from? Also, why do we need it? It's also stronger than the godly soul. Why is that? You would think the godly soul should have the upper hand and should be the stronger one. So to address all these questions, we went in to talk about the fact that in Kabbalah, everything is defined by lights and vessels. And we use these various different ways to illustrate it, whether it's a vision and a strategy in a business, words and an idea in a book. You can't have one without the other. If you just have words that are messed up, they're not going to capture any ideas. That's like vessels, but they're not doing their job. They won't capture any ideas. They won't capture the light. So you need both of them. And in order for things to operate successfully, they each need to realize that they need each other, like a good match, like a good marriage, and they each need to be committed to something greater than both of them. And then it could be successful. And that's what happened in reality in the world that we live in, spiritual worlds that we live in. And they are functioning well, because we are in the world of tikkun. Tikkun means that it's fixed and it's functioning. But why are we talking about a fixed world? As if it ain't broken, don't fix it, they say. Why are we in a fixed world? Because there was something broken before this world. We are used to the world of tikkun. Everything's operating correctly. But before this world, there was an attempt, which was called the world of tohu, big Kabbalistic idea. And this tohu means that it was a world of chaos. Why was it a world of chaos? In short, because over there, the lights and the vessels were not working in tandem. They did not acknowledge what their purpose was. They didn't realize, they didn't internalize the fact that they needed to be committed to something, a purpose and an objective greater than themselves. They failed to do so. The lights vanished. The vessels shattered. And that was the end of that. Now we're going to come to the final few minutes. But did you have a quick thing first?
My reading of Kabbalah, that there was a primordial light, a primordial vessel. The light was too intense for the vessel to hold.
Next week, we're talking about Tzimtzum. I didn't mean to cut you off, but
it's different than what this discussion is.
It's different. It's yeah. Now, ultimately, everything is relevant to everything, but that's not what we're exploring tonight. Lesson number 5 is called the Great Concealment. It's going to be addressed next week. So right now we're going to come to culminate what we opened with. Why do we have this animal soul? Why is it necessary? And the answer is because we have within ourselves a manifestation of both the world of tikkun, but also of the world of tohu. The godly soul represents tikkun. What is tikkun all about? What is the second world? Second meaning after the chaotic one, which was first. The world that we live in, why are we calling it tikkun, which means functioning? How does something function successfully? When you realize what your role is, and when you're able to be committed or even submitted to something that's higher than you. Which one of our two souls has that ability? The godly soul or the animal soul? The godly soul is able to acknowledge that there's something to be committed to, which is God and God's purpose. So that's where our godly soul comes from. But we also have an animal soul. And the animal soul is there because it's a manifestation of tohu. It actually originates in these shattered vessels of tohu. That's where our animal soul comes from. Remember we asked before, where does it come from if we're just a mirror image of God? The answer is that we need to have this animal soul, and it originates in tohu. And we'll now see the various different ways how our animal soul specifically has the same characteristics as the world of tohu. Let's take a look.
That's how we ended up with the flood.
And this is how we ended up with the flood. Well, I mean, the flood was already in the world of tikkun, actually.
Right.
But within tikkun, we almost lost it again, but it was saved. Thank God and thank Noah. Okay, let's hone in over here. So tohu means a system in which divine lights and vessels fail to sense God's ultimate purpose for which they had been emanated, resulting in the lights returning to their source and the vessels remaining without the lights. That's what tohu means.
That's a really complicated concept.
It is. I told you when we set out tonight that it's going to be a big one.
God is God, and how can anybody subvert his purpose or anything?
Well, we have free choice.
we can choose to live out God's purpose or not.
We do, but
so it's all on a more refined spiritual level, obviously, because it's closer to God, so it's not even something independent. But somehow, on that level, the light has some measure of the ability to either be submitted or not, even on that spiritual level. So that's what that world of Tohu is, which failed, and that's why we needed a restart, which is Tikkun, the world that we're in. And we also had the breaking of the vessels, when the vessels no longer lend definition to the lights, but become standalone entities. And now, let's go. So the solution is Tikkun, which is to be aware of God's deep wish, and that's when each one of these 10 are integrated with lights and vessels, and they're each doing what they were called upon to do. The second emanation of the Sphero, in which the lights and vessels sense God's purpose, causing them to set aside their default natures and allowing them to remain pure with each other. All right, so I wanted to get to this, and with this we're kind of gonna culminate. So we spoke about the fact that we have a godly soul and an animal soul, but each one comes from a different source. So we have an animal soul and the godly soul. Now, if you see, yeah. And now we'll identify the correlation between our two souls and where they originate in. So, for starters, what did we say before? Which soul comes into us first?
Animal.
The animal soul is first, which is aligned with the fact that which one of these two realities was first? Was it chaos, Tohu, or Tikkun? Which one was first?
Chaos
was first. So the animal soul which comes from there also comes into us first. That's number one. Number two, which soul is more self-centered versus mission-oriented? Is the godly soul, mission-oriented or self-centered?
Mission-oriented.
The animal soul is self-centered. Where does it come from? Where do each of them come from? The godly soul, of course, comes from God. So it's mission-oriented. The animal soul comes from the world of Tohu. And the world of Tohu was defined by not being mission-oriented. That's why chaos ensued. That's why the vessels shattered, because the lights in the vessels were not committed to their purpose and mission. The animal soul, which is self-centered, originates in Tohu, which was also self-centered, because it didn't pay attention to the greater good. Number three, deviation versus loyalty, the same thing. The godly soul is loyal to its purpose and its mission and to God. The animal soul comes from Tohu, so it deviated from its purpose. Broken vessels versus complete vessels. Think of a life defined by the godly soul versus the animal soul. If somebody lives their life defined by the animal soul, and just imagine, okay, people on my streets all the time, maybe many of you here, take your dog for a walk in the morning. Okay, imagine instead of you walking your dog is walking you. There's nothing wrong with it, but if the dog leads, where are you going to end up? You may get lost, you may be led who knows where. So imagine a life that's defined by the animal soul, not you leading it, but it leading you. Which means that anything that you encounter, that you desire, that you want, you're just going to carry it out and pursue it and fulfill it. You're basically going to end up like a shattered vessel, because that's the definition of the animal soul pursuing everything it wants, and which means we're going to be left all over the place. That, if we live a life defined by the animal soul, it will be like the world of Tohu. It will be a place of shattered vessels versus complete vessels, which is where the godly soul comes from. And finally, we said powerful versus average strength. The godly soul, it's not super strong, because it's more submitted. It may be a little more timid as a result of that, because it acknowledges something higher than it. The animal soul, on the other hand, originates in the world of Tohu, and therefore it's more powerful, because the world of Tohu was defined by the lights not allowing themselves to be captured in a vessel. In other words, they were too intense. They were left to be intense. The animal soul comes from those intense lights of tohu, as opposed to tikkun, where the vessel actually subdues the light and actually gives it specific definition. In tohu, where it was chaotic, the lights were left to be intense and not tolerating each other, etc. The animal soul comes from there, therefore it also has that strength and power. So, this answered many of the questions and told us where the animal soul comes from. And it also addressed many of the specific functions of the animal soul and why it has these unique characteristics. And now, just to really bring this all home, when we talk about, so why do we have it? Last question that we need to address. Why do we even have this animal soul? It's very nice to know where it comes from. We learned all about it. We learned that its characteristics are because it comes from the world of tohu. But why do we need it?
So it's because you have a survival.
But we have a godly soul. Why do we need the animal soul too? This whole...
So we can have free will.
Survival. It's all correct. Ultimately, the purpose is in text number 9. Jake, want to read that one for us, please?
Sure. Number 9 is
yes.
All the mitzvot are designed exclusively to purify the animal soul and mortal body. By contrast, the divine soul does not require rectification. It has no intrinsic need to become installed within an animal soul and mortal body. The sole purpose for doing so is for it to illuminate and rectify them. Understand this well. The reason the soul descends to this world is to rectify and purify.
Thank you, Jake. You said it. The reason why we're here in this world, okay, big line here, big idea. We're all asking this question every day. Why are we here? What's our purpose and mission in this world? And the last line sums it up. It's why we're here, and it's also why we're given an animal soul. And the animal soul specifically with its unique characteristics. The reason why we have it is so that we shall harness its power to serve God as well. The godly soul serves God naturally. But that's not enough. If it was all about the godly soul could have stayed in heaven. Why was it sent down here into a body together with an animal soul? And now to go live your life together. The answer is because the godly soul has a goal and objective to harness the power of the animal soul and cultivate it to also support its godly aspirations. So we are here to serve God, but we can do so just with a godly soul. The animal soul is here so that we should be able to channel its power. Remember, which one's stronger? The animal soul is much stronger. So we need to cultivate the animal soul over to our side, to the godly side. And then when we serve God and do good things, we have a much greater horsepower than we would have just on our own with the godly soul without the animal soul. When we harness the power of the animal soul, then we achieve much, much more in this world. And let's just bring it down in a few words. What does that mean to make it a little bit more practical? So first of all, you know, sometimes somebody goes to Starbucks. Some people leave their dog outside, right? I'm not sure what the policy is, if you're allowed to take it in or not, but many people leave it outside. Others take it inside. What Hasidic teaching is giving us is that we don't leave the dog outside. The point that the dog, the animal soul, is not a distraction. It could be a distraction. But if we are doing things right and we're integrating, then we actually should be able to take the animal with us, and instead of it leading us, we lead it, and we harness its power, and we take its unique strengths, and utilize them, and cultivate them over to the side of good, and to the side of the godly and the goodly. And then we are able to serve God and do mitzvahs in a much stronger and more powerful way. I'm going to give you one example for this, and with that we'll close. Think about the fact, you know, very often, there's a certain natural tendency that people have, that when you do something good, people generally don't like to look for attention when they do something good. They don't look to advertise it. It's more modest, you know, I'm doing a mitzvah, God knows about it, no one else needs to know about it. which is a good thing in essence. However, the problem with today's world is that what makes headlines? When you walk on the streets, what's flashing and making headlines? It's all the negative energy of the world. The headlines is all bad news. What's flashing is all the negativity and all the distractions. That's what's loud. That's what's making the noise. What we have to do is we have to take that capability for noise in the world and somehow transform it over to the positive. So yes, if someone is doing a mitzvah nowadays, it may be necessary to make some positive noise with that mitzvah. Not that we should desire it, but we should make the noise anyway, because we have to counteract the negative energy and the negative noise with positive energy and positive noise. And my point here is that think, for example, if you may be aware that in the 1970s, the Rebbe started this program of going out. You know, he was based in New York, so they would go out to the streets of Manhattan with these RVs and call them mitzvah tanks. You may have heard of it. I mean, they're all over the world now. But it started in New York in the 70s. What was the point? The point was, is that how exactly should the world work? So all the Times Square should be flashing with everything negative, and the mitzvahs should be done like very quietly in the synagogue, and only if somebody knows and is comfortable showing up, then they may have some exposure to Judaism. He said, we're going to flip it on its head. And he told them to rent these RVs. Eventually they bought them. And they plastered them with images of mitzvahs, of tefillin, of Shabbos candles, of mezuzahs, and go out there. I can't to say that millions of Jews were touched by these RVs would be an understatement since the 70s. And this happens regularly in cities all over the world. What's the point? He understood America. He understood what the idols of America are when it comes to advertising and the flashy component of it. And he said, let's take it and let's harness it for a holy purpose. We're taking the power of the world of Tohu, of the power of the animal, and we're going to harness it and utilize it to strengthen the side of holiness. This is why there's negativity in the world, and this is why we have that animal soul. Not just to bother us and to distract us, it's actually there so that if we do it right, we can actually have it support all of our good ideals and mitzvahs and positivity that we engage in. Whew, thank you for joining us for lesson 4 of The World of Chaos. Wow. How was that?
Powerful.
Okay, if anyone has any questions, with pleasure. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.